You're listening to a Hindustan Times podcast brought to you by HT Smartcast.
Welcome to season 2 of our podcast Kicks for Free, in which we discuss all things football. I am Dhiman, and with me is my co-host Vivek.
Messi!
Edouard Mendy is the latest, but possibly not the last big name to move from a top European club to one in the Saudi Pro League. Ruben Neves, Kalidou Koulibaly too have moved recently after Karim Benzema and N'Golo Kante. Such has been the spate of activity that Cristiano Ronaldo's transfer to Al Nassr seems a long time ago.
To find out what this means to club football, whether we'll see a shift in power structure from Europe to Asia, or whether this is just Saudi Arabia's attempt at sport washing, or is there something bigger that they are trying to gain from this, not just the 2030 World Cup, we spoke to Simon Chadwick, professor of sport and geopolitical economy at Schema Business School.
Hi, Simon.
Hi, Vivek.
Simon, as one of the editors of the book, The Geopolitical Economy of Sport, how do you see Saudi Arabia's investment in the Pro League? Is it sports washing? Is it an attempt to develop its league? Or is it a means to maybe making a serious pitch for the 2030 World Cup or thereafter?
There are lots of things happening. And I think to characterize it as just one thing alone or one or two things is misplaced and simplistic. I guess the first thing that we've got to say about Saudi Arabia is football is Saudi Arabia's number one sport. Mm-hmm. If you look at, for instance, the Riyadh Derby, Al Nassr Al Hilal, you're talking about a match that typically might draw 50 or 60,000 people. And this is not just this season or just this month. This is something that has happened over a long period of time. And indeed, if we were to look at the performance of Saudi Arabian clubs in international competition, so for instance, the Asian Champions League, as you may know, Al Hilal made it to the Champions League final this last season. They lost the final to Urawa Red Diamonds, right, of Japan. But there is a history of success amongst clubs. There's also a history of success with the national team too. Of course, if you go back to 1994, that was their first qualification. And over recent editions of the tournament, they've been regular qualifiers. So this is not somehow whimsical. It's not China. And lots of people have made the comparison between Saudi Arabia and China. What there has been is a desire amongst the authorities in Saudi Arabia to change the nature of Saudi Arabian football. And so as early as 2015, if we go back to 2015, which obviously is the best part of a decade ago, there were plans announced to privatize Saudi Arabian football clubs. And of course, we now know that a couple of weeks ago that the privatization plans, the actual privatization plans were confirmed. And the intention of these privatization plans was to improve the commercial performance of clubs, in particular revenue generation. And what we now know from the plans that have been revealed is that is absolutely what Saudi Arabia wants to do. And the ambition is to have its top clubs appearing amongst the top revenue generating clubs across the world. There is a foundation in terms of popularity. There has been a strategic intent to change Saudi Arabian football, which we've seen through the privatization plan. But of course, the factor that I think has accelerated everything and brought the attention is Mohammed bin Salman. And there are several reasons why I think Mohammed bin Salman is really focusing not just on football, but sport more generally. And the bad news is for Indian Premier League cricket fans is his ambitions do embrace cricket as well. Is that the country is hugely dependent upon oil and gas revenues. We're looking at somewhere between 40 and 50% of gross domestic product is accounted for by oil and gas. So this is a hugely vulnerable economy, especially in this age when we're kicking back against fossil fuel consumption. So there is a process of economic transformation taking place whereby in Saudi Arabia invests in other industrial sectors, not just football, not just sport, but entertainment and tourism, the digital economy, alternative sources of energy and so forth. So football is just one of a number of different things that are being invested into. There is also, as part of that economic transformation, a desire to change business culture in Saudi Arabia, which has been, as one Saudi Arabian recently described football to me, it's communist. It's been communist for quite a while. And so there is this desire to promote enterprise and to promote a more commercial orientation. The country has a population of Gen Z consumers. 70% of the population is aged under 35. This population has been born and brought up on Instagram and Netflix and Real Madrid and Chanel handbags and Gucci shoes, just like every other Gen Z consumer across the world. And so Mohammed bin Salman is trying to cater for this segment of the population. What's I think really significant is that the Saudi Arabian government fears another Arab Spring, and a disaffected, disillusioned, alienated Gen Z population. What Mohammed bin Salman doesn't want is them knocking on the doors of government with Molotov cocktails in their hands. And so this is part of a new social contract that is emerging in Saudi Arabia, which is essentially, you want Cristiano Ronaldo, we'll give him to you. You want the World Cup, we'll try and give that to you. You want Champions League qualification every year for your top clubs, we'll give that to you. But in return, don't challenge us. And so this is also part of the story, but otherwise we there's a lot of discussion about sport washing and managing image and reputation. But this is sport washing is a new term, but managing image and reputation through sport is not. And immediately I'm thinking about the British and India and cricket and the nasty things that happen. But nevertheless, you've got cricket, so forget about all the nasty stuff.
We've even got football, but it's not talked about as much.
Yeah. Hey, I've got lots and lots and lots and lots of my former Indian students who've told me consistently over nearly two decades, football is popular in India, Simon. Don't forget it. But we do know that there are image and reputational benefits that a country can secure through an investment in sport. Some people might call it sport washing. Some people might call it soft power. But what I do think we all know is that being a prominent member of the global sporting community brings legitimacy for a country. And we only need to think about, for example, Switzerland, the home of sport governance. You've got 45, 50 global sports governing bodies have their headquarters in Switzerland, and Switzerland, reliable and trustworthy. And I'm sure there's a lot of bad things happening in Switzerland as well, but we tend not to talk about those things. Similarly, again, with me, whenever I travel the world, people don't want to talk to me about colonial Britain and about persecution and exploitation and appropriation. They want to tell me about their favorite Premier League football team. And so we know that absolutely sport is a currency that brings legitimacy and enables a conversation to start. And we do tend to think about the nasty things and think instead about the sport and the football and the big stars.
Simon, you mentioned the IPL, and do you see a situation where, the football structure, the football world sort of changes in the way IPL has changed the situation in cricket, where India has become pretty much the superpower in the sport? So do you see that happening with Saudi Arabia in the near or distant future? Saudi Arabia becoming the football hub, at least club football-wise?
There is no doubt that Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabian government sees the country and sees itself as being at the center of a new world. We are living in changing times. There's a great book by Parag Khanna, an Indian public diplomat. He wrote a great book 3 or 4 years ago called The Future is Asian. And there is absolutely a pivot from global north to global south. I don't think Europe's dead yet, and I don't think the United States is dead yet. But India is certainly alive and kicking, and China is alive and kicking. And now Saudi Arabia, as we know, is not just alive and kicking, but is screaming the house down at the same time. So what I think is really fascinating about the world is obviously Europeans and Americans are perturbed by what is happening, but we're seeing this emerging battle in Asia, you know, in essence, for who is going to be number one in you know, who's going to be center of this new world order. And the positioning of Saudi Arabian government is that the country is an Afro-Eurasian hub, which, you know, if you're American, sorry, you know, that kind of tends to imply that you're being marginalized. If you're a European, phew, you know, I can, thankfully, we're still in the game. But I know, as a British guy, wherever I go in the world, I know the value of the currency that I have on my mobile phone or on a TV screen, or which is, you know, maybe it's Premier League football, maybe it's cricket, you know, maybe it's motorsport, because, you know, most of the Formula One teams in motorsport are still based in Britain.
Right.
But I think Saudi Arabia takes the view that we want that. You know, this is a winner all costs game. And this is not, well, you know, maybe we could buy a lower league team, or, you know, maybe we could invest in badminton, because nobody's invested in badminton up until now. You know, we're talking about in at the top, trying to become the best, positioning ourselves as the center of the new world order, and, you know, being the league, being the sport industry, having the stars that people talk about, you know. So, you know, don't talk about IPL and Indian cricket. Talk about cricket in Saudi Arabia. Don't talk about Premier League football in England. Talk about the Saudi Pro League. So, you know, this is big. Is it going to be a success? Who knows? You know, let's see. You know, we could talk about that. But certainly the ambition and the resources are there.
Simon, you mentioned about the Chinese Super League. Is state funding the only difference between, say, what is happening in the Saudi Pro League and what happened in China back in 2015-16? And is that also why you think this investment could be a lot more long-term, because the state is involved?
What I think is really important to stress is a point I made in response to your earlier question, which, as we would say in Britain, it's like comparing chalk and cheese. Comparing Saudi Arabia and China is like comparing chalk and cheese, meaning that their relationship with football is different. Whereas in Saudi Arabia, where, you know, football is the number one sport, in China, football is not the number one sport. You know, at best, it was a minority interest sport. It's still a minority interest sport. It just so happens that in a huge nation, that minority is actually quite a lot of people, certainly in terms of European standards. But football has only ever been a minority sport in China. What I also think is the difference is that Saudi Arabia understands football in a way that I think that China doesn't. And I'm talking about a governmental level. And that governmental understanding of football is born of decades of engagement with the sport. In China, officials were relatively new to the game and they made mistakes, but I also think they fell foul of, for example, unscrupulous agents. Because if you go back to 2015-16, we saw something that was a bit like a new gold rush. It was like the new Klondike. And I've always had this sense that Chinese officials really were ill-equipped to deal with what they were confronted with. And, you know, a prime example for me is Carlos Tevez moving from Boca Juniors to China, being paid $660,000 a week, US dollars a week, spending 10 months in China. And when he got back to South America 10 months later, he said, I had a really nice holiday in China and got paid lots of money for it. I'm not in any way suggesting that Saudi Arabian clubs may not fall foul of the similar maneuvers of intermediaries and agents. But I think that Saudi Arabia has a much sharper sense at this point of what it's trying to do. And it will control, monitor and control some of the unscrupulous activity in ways that we perhaps didn't see in China. And you've got to keep in mind, you know, you go back to 2018 and what happened with Jamal Khashoggi, what happened with the Ritz-Carlton episode when large numbers of very prominent business people in Saudi Arabia were invited to stay in the Ritz-Carlton for a short while, and they were reminded of their fiscal responsibilities to the nation. So I think it's very clear already that corrupt activity and unscrupulous activity in Saudi Arabia will not be countenanced. It will be tackled. So I think we are talking about two very different situations in Saudi Arabia and China. There are some similarities. You know, obviously less well-established nations in football perhaps will make some mistakes, but I think the raw materials and the operating parameters in Saudi Arabia are much better defined than they were in China.
Would you also say that they've also learned from the Chinese experience, if at all? Or do you think that they don't need to learn from that because the systems there are well more organized anyway?
What I'm finding really interesting about Saudi Arabia right now is certainly Saudi Arabian football right now is obviously Ronaldo and N'Golo Kanté and Karim Benzema. You know, they're grabbing the attention and public investment.
Ruben Neves now as well.
Ruben Neves, and you've got the public investment fund involvement at Newcastle United. So really our attention has been caught by this. But what I found interesting about the country is A lot of the governing institutions, the commercial partners and others are hiring in the top talent from around the world as well. And so what you're getting, which you didn't have in China, I guess during the boom years of Chinese football, you had Chinese governors and Chinese administrators trying to govern and administer. Whereas in Saudi Arabia, what you have is an ecosystem developing that is populated by top talent from around the world. And so these are incredibly well-educated, incredibly successful people who have a track record of making, you know, leading and managing, making decisions in football. I guess what this does tend to suggest, and for me, I think there are two things from a Saudi Arabian perspective, is making this all join up. Because it's, as we've seen through, you know, from many cases in the past, you can have the top talent, right, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to perform well. And so, you know, making sure that all of these top people who are making decisions in different organizations, making sure that joins up is one challenge. But I think also there's something about the vision and the planning in Saudi Arabia is almost impeccable. But obviously operationalizing those strategies and monitoring and controlling them is something completely different. And if we take NEOM, one of the, not a mega project, a giga project, right, now taking place in Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman and the government clearly has a vision and a plan. But what we're now seeing is even the European architect of NEOM is saying, I'm not sure we can build this. You know, this is impossible to build. So this gap, this strategic gap between vision and planning and actual operationalization and the monitoring and control of these plans, you know, this is also a factor in football, I think, that is relevant.
There's been obviously a lot of interest in the Saudi Pro League post-Ronaldo, and now obviously that interest has skyrocketed with Benzema, N'Golo Kanté, Ruben Neves, possibly Bernardo Silva. Do you see this interest being reflected? You know, the Athletic put out a report the other day that the IMG, Saudi Pro League, has asked IMG to sell international broadcast rights. Do you see that happening? I mean, do you see that a fair amount of interest being generated for this league? Or is football too traditional to look beyond the usual places?
That's a good question. And I think what is happening in Saudi Arabia is an interesting experiment, because if we take the most commercially lucrative football league in the world, which of course is the English Premier League, it has essentially taken the Premier League decades to attain the position that it now has. And you know, we think about the formation of the Premier League in 1992. That's 30 years ago. But the story goes back a little further than that, even, because what a lot of people don't realize about English football compared to football elsewhere in Europe and football elsewhere in the world is in the 1960s, the English Football Association was selling rights to English football matches around the world. And so La Liga, Serie A and others have been playing catch up over the last two or three decades. And what we're now saying is that actually in reality, Saudi Arabia is somehow going to do it better than them. And I guess the comparison that the Saudi Arabians would make is, well, hey, look, you know, 2 years ago, we didn't have a presence in professional golf. And now effectively we run professional golf.
We run golf. Yes.
Yeah. We run golf. And so the scale of the ambition, you know, some people might call it arrogance, is there for us to see. It's going to be an interesting strategic battle because, as I say, the competitive advantage that the English Premier League has globally has been accumulated over a period of decades, whereas Saudi Arabia is trying to do this over a period of years. It is interesting that they've approached IMG because clearly one of the main channels through which people engage with a sport worldwide is, you know, very simply, can they watch it on TV? Can they access it on their mobile device? Is there a box set series on Netflix? And so on and so forth. And, you know, we think again about Indian Premier League cricket, you know, TV and broadcasting, satellite TV, right. More recently, digital technology has helped build and then sustain the league. So we know the lessons are there. And what essentially Saudi Arabia is saying is, you know, the British, it's taking you too long. You know, it's taken you 50 or 60 years to do this. You know, even India, it's taken you a decade or so to do this. We're going to do this in double quick time. And that, as I say, I think is a really, really interesting strategic experiment. Let's see in 2030, if we're all supporting Al Hilal and Al Nasser, then maybe it worked. But I think, you know, perhaps Saudi Arabia is overestimating the power of its football, but is perhaps also underestimating how deeply embedded we all are in our existing engagements with football. And so for me, I think a more realistic expectation is perhaps 2040 or 2050. I draw comparison with Japanese football.
Right.
1990, Japanese football had no global visibility or presence. J League was established in the early 90s, and here we are now. Japan performs pretty well in the World Cup. It's got some of Asia's top club teams. You know, it's got players going all over the world to play in some of the biggest leagues. So I think for me, the real benchmark is Japan for Saudi Arabia, and perhaps not the English Premier League.
Simon, good that you mentioned the J League, because it's about greater depth, isn't it? In terms of like judging a league, no matter how many top players you sign, the overall quality for that to go up, it'll take obviously maybe one or two decades, and a lot more needs to be done than just signing the Ronaldos and the Benzemas.
Again, that's a really interesting question, a good question, and if we look at again the experience of the English Premier League is in 1991, there was a report published called The Blueprint for the Future of English Football. And there were essentially three headlines to that blueprint. Is number one, create a Premier League. Number two, make more money from that Premier League. Number three, enhance national team performance. Now, what's really interesting is in many ways, the Premier League has done what it says on the tin, which, you know, make more money. What the Premier League has been less successful in achieving is enhanced national team performance. You know, the English national team has not won anything since then. And so I think kind of taking that and applying the logic to the Saudi Pro League, you know, we've got to ask the question, what do you want to do? And so far, it seems to me that what the Saudi Pro League is saying is, we want a more commercially lucrative league. We want more commercially lucrative clubs. And I guess in simple terms, you know, in Saudi Arabia right now, we're working off a pretty low base. So inevitably, their revenues are going to increase. Inevitably, their commercial performance has to improve because it's been fairly non-existent up until now. But I think when we begin to look at other metrics like national team performance, going back to your question, is if you're hiring in lots of talent from around the world, so you've got fantastic club teams, you know, and the people of Mumbai and Manchester, instead of wearing City or United shirts, they're wearing Al Hilal and Al Nassr shirts. You know, that's great. That's great. But if national team performance either doesn't improve or perhaps even suffers as a consequence of this, you know, the question then becomes, you know, so what next? You know, what are you going to do? And it's at that point, I think, then, you know, there is a point at which there will need to be a debate about Saudi Arabian national team performance. And as you've rightly pointed out, that requires a long-term stream of talent to be playing in the Pro League. And this does therefore demand, you know, what is Saudi Arabia going to do in terms of governance and in terms of the rules regarding domestic talent? And just last week, the English Football Association post-Brexit has introduced new rules about the development of domestic talent. And I think one of the things that we're going to have to look carefully at as Saudi Arabia continues with its spending spree is at which point does it say, ah, okay, we need to consider how we develop domestic talent. This was an issue for China as well. Mm-hmm. And you may recall in China, the government essentially started to make up rules as they were going along, like the goalkeeper must be Chinese.
Right.
But you had this rule in China, the Chinese Super League at one stage, there must only be four foreigners on the pitch at any one time. So strategically, I think there are some important decisions that Saudi Arabia faces regarding its own domestic talent, what it wants to achieve. One thing that we haven't mentioned, if I could just say a little more, is about its women's football.
Mm-hmm.
Because although, you know, there is a grassroots and there is the development of a national team, you know, in essence, women's football does not exist. And certainly if you look at the FIFA ranking of the Saudi Arabian women's team, it's bad. And if you look at it longitudinally, there is no FIFA ranking because women couldn't play football. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the other things too to consider in all of this is what happens with the development of women's football. Are they going to develop this talent pipeline? Are they going to hire in talent? And if we are looking to 2030, 2040, 2050, what is going to happen to the Saudi Arabian women's teams, but also to the women's national teams' FIFA rankings?
Right. So, you know, you mentioned this point about Saudi Arabia's national team. Now, one of the things that is true for Saudi Arabia and for the other West Asian countries, and in a way true for India also, is that unlike Japan or Iran or South Korea, you don't have too many players who are going to Europe to try their luck, okay, and as a consequence improve, which is why the Japanese national team, which is why the Iranian national team or the South Korean national team is possibly better than the Saudi Arabian national team. Why do you think that happens? Is it because there's a lot of money in the game and there's very little incentive to move out, which is definitely the case in India because the pool of players is small and the ones who are there get a lot of money and there's very little incentive to move out? Is that the same in Saudi Arabia as well?
I think there are several things happening. I think of a player like Omar Abdulrahman.
Right.
From the United Arab Emirates and you know, kind of the Messi of the Middle East at one mm-hmm. stage. I think I heard him being described. And I spoke to West Asian fans about Omar Abdulrahman and said, well, you know, so how is he? And I think it was a rumor at one stage that he might sign for Everton in the Premier League. And my friends in the Gulf region said to me, it will never happen. And they were right, it never happened. And one of the reasons is that economically, financially, there was just no need for him to leave because he was incredibly well remunerated. And he was a big fish in a very small pond. You know, clearly by moving to one of the European leagues, it would have got tougher for him, without a doubt. The level of competition would have been greater. in terms of the damage to his brand, in terms of the damage to his financial arrangements, he decided, just stay in the United Arab Emirates. That's the easiest way to do it. So I think there is clearly something about the economic incentives that the region potentially provides. But I also think it's something about the opportunities that are available. What I found really, really interesting currently, certainly about the English Premier League, is that the English Premier League suddenly has woken up to South Korean players. And obviously Son at Tottenham Hotspur has been a trailblazer in that regard. But there has been this realization that, these guys are actually pretty good players. And so we're now beginning to see more players coming to the Premier League and more South Korean players coming to Europe more generally. If we then look at what's happened in South Korea, there has been a long-term strategy for the development of this talent. And the strategy is bearing fruit. And with players like Son, that has brought legitimacy, but also a level of trust. And there is this, I think there is this view in European football that if you're buying a South Korean player now, you're not taking a gamble. There are reasons to believe that they can perform at the top level in Europe. So, as far as India is concerned, this kind of legitimacy and trust equation
is not there.
It's not there. We simply don't know enough. And there is a post-colonial arrogance almost that, in India, they don't really play football. They're only interested in cricket and, they don't have the skills that we're looking for. I think in this regard, it does require almost those Indian players to be marketing them. If they're looking for a big money move to the Premier League or La Liga or Serie A, it is almost as though they've got to convince the buyers that they have the requisite skills and they can perform. I guess one of the things that we should think about in all of this is the role that data analysis plays in all of this, because clearly player analytics helps ease decisions. It helps ease some of those concerns about, are we signing a player who can run? Are we signing a player who can tackle? But even so, I still think there is this, there's something intuitive about player signings and there are issues of legitimacy and trust still. And for Saudi Arabia, this is an issue. If we think about ahead of the World Cup in 2018, there was a deal agreed between the Spanish FA and the Saudi Arabian FA that players from Saudi Arabia could go to Spain and prepare for the 2018 World Cup playing for Spanish clubs. And that's essentially what it was. It was a preparation agreement. Right. None of those players signed for Spanish clubs. We've not seen any perceptible improvement in Saudi Arabian national team performance. So there's still some way to go. And I think it's about analytics. I think it's about strategy. But as I say, it's also about legitimacy and trust as well.
Well, yeah. Finally, Simon, do you think, whichever way you look at it, the interest in the Asian Champions League is going to skyrocket because of the signings? Because you could have Mumbai City playing a team that has Ronaldo, for instance, or Benzema. So Asian Champions League is not exactly a most watched football tournament competition. Do you think that's going to, the interest in that is definitely going to increase?
So I'm going to say, you probably never imagined in your life that you'd hear an English guy say this. But I hope so. I really hope so. I really see myself this kind of Afro-Eurasian positioning that Saudi Arabia has. I also have this positioning. I would really, really love to see Asian football in general occupying a much, much more prominent position in the minds of football fans globally. We think already about what Asia's got. You think about the Tehran Derby, for example, which is the biggest derby match in the world. And that's without women attending. And if women could also attend that, imagine how big that derby potentially could be. And then, of course, you come through India. And I do know that there is significant engagement with football in India. You then come through countries like Vietnam, and I'm keeping an eye on Vietnam because there seems to be an appetite for football in Vietnam that has led to some significant national team successes recently. And then, of course, you've then got the powerhouses of Japan and South Korea. You've got Australia too. Mm-hmm. What I think is significant for me always is about Asian football is you don't have super brands. So you don't have super clubs, super brands like Real Madrid and Juventus and Bayern Munich. And I think partly the AFC has to play a role. But I also think that officials within these clubs, you know, within the likes of Urawa Red Diamonds and within clubs like Al Hilal, need to take a more expansive, global and proactive view of who they are and what they can do. I mean, if we take Indian clubs, for example, you know, the global Indian diaspora, as you know, is huge. And certainly as an English guy, you know, if I think about the second and third generation South Asians that I have as friends, yeah, they're big Manchester United fans. Of course, they're supporting the England national team, but they're also keeping an eye on IPL franchises. They're keeping an eye on an Indian Super League club somewhere. And so I think in terms of the commercial development of Asian football, I think the country's big enough and have an appetite significant enough to make something of football, but I also think the diasporas across the world as well can help in this.
Right. Thank you, Simon. Thank you so much for talking to us. Yeah,
it's been an absolute pleasure. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
And thank you for interviewing me.
That was it for this episode. If you want to reach out to us, you can find us on our Twitter handles at Vivek9301 and at DemanHD. If you're a true football fan, you cannot not subscribe to Kickoff, our weekly newsletter on the World Game, which hits inboxes every Friday. For more updates on this podcast, follow HT Smartcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn. And to listen to more such podcasts, log on to htsmartcast.com.
To stay updated on this podcast, follow us at HT Smartcast on all the major social media platforms. To listen to more such podcasts, log on to www.htsmartcast.com.